Welcome to Morph Into a New You, part of MHNRnetwork.com. Your host, Johnny Calloway, is the author of several books, including Taming the Dragon, Dragons to Butterflies, The Metamorphosis of a Man, and The Bridge. He will be having conversations with people from all walks of life. Healing really is an inside job that transforms you to become a better version of you. We must change our self-talk and inner dialogue so we can start to believe. A special thanks to our sponsor, Meaningful Expressions, at m-expressions.com. They can take a concept, thought, or personal brand and turn it into a visual masterpiece that you can use to raise awareness about your passion or cause. They've certainly done that with our podcast website. And thank you for joining Johnny as you morph into a new you.
Hello, everybody. I'm Johnny Calloway, host of Morph Into a New You. And we're here today with my dear friend, Eric Gentry, Dr. Eric Gentry. He was with us once before, and we talked about post-traumatic stress disorder, psychology, and spirituality. Today, we're going to continue that talk in a sense, because we're going to talk about how trauma and codependency, how they connect. And after our last talk, I really believe they do connect. And I'm going to ask Eric if he'll give us a little feed on that. And at the end of the show, we'll talk about how to find Eric and what all he does and a little more about Eric. But right now, I'm just anxious to dive into the meat of this show. So, Eric, tell us about what you know about it.
Well, I guess that I would say that codependency is the outcome of attachment trauma.
I like it.
That's what causes what we call, kind of in pop psychology or colloquial language, codependency. What it is truly is the intolerance of intimacy.
The intolerance of intimacy.
Uh-huh.
Okay. You're going to have to dig into that one for me here.
I'm happy to. And I think I want to start with the ACE. Did I talk about that last time?
The what?
The ACE.
No, you didn't.
So let me start with that, because it's a nice grounding, and it's very much in vogue right now. If you've heard the term trauma-informed care, it's come from the research around the ACE. And ACE stands for Aversive Childhood Experiences. And it started with an internist in California who began researching. He was working at a weight loss center, and he was doing bariatric surgery and also running a weight loss program. And he found that his name was Vincent Felitti, and he found that a lot of folks were dropping out of the weight loss program. And as he was doing his H&Ps, history and physicals, with the folks that he was about to do bariatric surgery with, one of the things that he discovered is that every single one of those folks that had obesity had histories of childhood abuse. And he got intrigued by that. He developed a survey and sent it out to a bunch of ex-patients from Kaiser, and found that there was a huge correlation, that the higher the ACE scores, there's 10 items on it. I'll go over those with you in just a second. The higher the score, the more likely they were to have obesity. And then Kaiser got excited about that, and they did a couple of other studies in the late, this is late 90s, with unwanted pregnancy, smoking, and chemical dependency. And they found that the higher your ACE score, there's possible 10 items, the closer you got to 10, the more likely you were to have those negative outcomes. Since then, the CDC has gotten involved with it, and there's been 30 studies, and just every bad healthcare outcome that you can think of, from COPD to liver disease to heart disease to suicide, is the higher your ACE score, the closer it is to 10, the more likely it is you're going to have bad healthcare outcomes. And, you know, stuff like you're 46th, if you've got a score of six, you're 46 times more likely to inject drugs, to use IV drugs than somebody that has, 46 times. That's crazy. 1,500% more likely to successfully suicide if you have a score of four or higher.
Wow.
Yeah. So just really quickly, I'll run through those items, and there's 10 of them. And it says, did a parent or other adult in the household often swear at you, insult you, put you down, or humiliate you, or act in a way that made you afraid that you might be physically hurt? If the answer is yes, the score is one. If the answer is no, it's a zero. Did a parent or other adult in the household often push, slap, grab, or throw something at you, ever hit you so hard that there were marks? Yes, one. No, zero. Did an adult at least 5 years older than you ever touch, fondle, or have you touched their body in a sexual way? Or did somebody attempt or actually have oral, anal, or vaginal intercourse with you? One yes, zero no. Did you often feel that no one in your family loved you or thought you were important or special? Or your family didn't look out for each other, feel close to each other, or support each other? One yes, zero no. Did you often or very often feel that you did not have enough to eat, had to wear dirty clothes, or had no one to protect you, or that your parents were too drunk or too high to take care of you or take you to the doctor if you needed it? Were your parents ever separated, divorced? Seven, was your mother often hit, slapped, grabbed, or something thrown at her, or sometimes kicked, bitten, hit with a fist, or hit with something hard, ever repeatedly hit at least a few times, or threatened with a gun or a knife? Was anyone in your home a problem drinker or alcoholic or used street drugs? Was a household member depressed or mentally ill, or did a household member attempt suicide? Did a household member go to prison? So those are 10 items, yes or no. And you can start to see that the more of those you get, the more traumatic your childhood was.
You don't want me to tell you my score on that, do you?
I bet it's about like mine. Mine's a 9.
Yeah, well, the only thing that I could say that there's even in question is not feeling loved, because the odd thing about my childhood is, I don't know how, but I always knew my dad loved me no matter what he was doing. Because somehow or another, he would do what he would do, but he would never let anybody else mess with me in any way. So there was a degree of knowing he loved me.
The way the ACE is written is, did anybody, for that to be a no answer, both parents would have had to have loved you, and that you knew that.
Yeah,
okay. If either of those caregivers were distant or drunk or high, then that would have been a yes score on that one.
Right.
Yeah. So see if you can follow this. You know, what happens to people that end up having trauma? The big deal with trauma is that it produces, after a person's been traumatized, it produces a perceived threat where there's very little or no danger. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Like that combat veteran comes back from combat and they perceive threat out of, you know, at McDonald's.
Right.
That's what trauma does. Well, attachment trauma in our development and family of origin, what that produces is fear of other people. That's the outcome of those scores. The higher that score, the more you perceive other people as threatening.
Okay, so I want to interject something here, because after our last show, I'm telling you, for 2 or 3 weeks, I kept chewing on that show. Because when you talked about secured attachment, that's what you called it, right?
Yeah, no D on it. Secure attachment.
Uh-huh. Secure attachment. Okay. Prior to my mother's death, when she passed, I was 5. I had that immensely. And then it was gone. Poof.
Yep.
So after that, every female that came into my life, I clung to like Velcro, looking for that. And, of course, nobody could do that the way that she did that. And I would literally, in my attempt to cling to it, after I got a little older, I would literally push them farther away from me more than draw them to me, because it was just too much. So, I mean, after that show we did, I'm like, yeah. And I had it, and then I lost it. And then briefly, for about a year after my mom died, for about a year, I had an aunt that I could go visit every other weekend that gave me that. And she kept trying to get pregnant, and she kept having miscarriages. So I was safe as long as she was having miscarriages. Once she had a pregnancy that took, I never got to go back to her house again. And it was taken again. And then my sister ran off, and it was just crazy. It just kept coming and going. So, yeah, I approached everything with, like, you ain't sticking around. You're not staying here. Terrified that whatever secure attachment I had was never going to last. So that's why I wanted to do this show.
So see if this fits to what you just told me. The real conundrum and heartbreaking thing that happens to children who have repeated trauma in childhood is that they're hungry. They are starved for connection, paired with the inability to tolerate. Yeah. I mean, we're laughing, but it's deeply sad, you know?
Really?
Because there's that insatiable hunger to get connected with a person. And just how, you know, it's dope. It is the organizing principle for a whole lot of people that have high A scores is that they are hungry to get attached. But then they can't hold on to themselves. Because as they begin to get intimate, as they begin to connect, the fear of loss becomes so great that they can't tolerate staying with the person. So what they start doing is they stop being themselves and they start watching and monitoring and attuning to the other to produce the behaviors that help, that support, that love the other. So that they won't leave them. They make what happens a person that has a high A score that is hungry for that, they make themselves indispensable in the life of their partner. And so that they are in a role in that relationship rather than able to be a whole person that is, you know, an equal relationship. It's always a one down position of caregiving. Because it's a way to deflect from my flawed self, that my partner won't see how flawed I am. If I can take care of them perfectly, if I am the perfect partner, if I'm able to give them everything that they want in somebody else. And so it becomes a role instead of an authentic relational process that is intimate and that's real.
Wow.
What about that, Johnny?
I'm on it, man. I'm on it. You couldn't have drawn me out a picture of me any better. No way. Because what I do is I become, even if the person is perfectly healthy, I become the caregiver. It's funny. I've always thought this was something that'd be attractive to a woman. I've said forever, if I'm riding down the road with my partner, and we drive by this lawn and they see a gazebo and they say, man, I really like that gazebo. It goes on a list in my head. It's like, I got to build her a gazebo. Yeah. And I'm not going to be happy whether she is or not. I'm not going to be happy till I put her a gazebo in the yard. And it doesn't matter if it's that or if it's a pair of earrings or a pair of shoes or whatever, whatever they say they want, it becomes my job in life to make sure they get it. Yeah, so yeah, you just nailed me to the wall, dude.
And now the really dark part of that is that once the gazebo gets built, then what I have gotten with that is now some entitlement.
Right, and it becomes like
I have earned your love. You owe me love now.
Right, right. It's what I call, I didn't have all the information that I'm getting from you right now, but it's what I call emotional bartering. You present it as, oh, it's a gift. I'm going to give you this gazebo. But it's really a barter, because what I'm doing is I'm under the guise of a gift. I'm saying I'm giving you a gazebo. But in the back of my mind, what happens is now you owe me, because it was a trade. It wasn't a gift. A gift is freely given. Now, thank God I've moved beyond that as a result of the crash I had a few years ago, about 10 now, when we met. And now I'm clear with myself. OK, this is a gift. And I can say to whoever, whether it's a girlfriend or whatever, I can say, you know what? I'm going to give you this. And I'm hoping in return, next time we want to go to a movie, I get to choose the movie. Instead of just getting pissed off because I don't get my turn when I never said I wanted or needed a turn. That makes sense?
That's right. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it's what, again, I call it emotional bartering. And then the other thing that I have said for a long time, coming from my Course in Miracles experience, where I first got this as part of my experience was really through my dad. Through watching my dad. And I would say, what my dad wants more than anything in the world is to be loved. And simultaneously, there is not another thing on this planet that frightens him more than being loved. And to me, that ties into what you just said. And it's me. It was me. I wanted that connection that you talked about so intently. But at the same time, if somebody did show up, if some woman showed up in my life that could give me that, I always called it that compassion, the connectedness, we'll call it. It's not what I called it at the time, but that female energy of like loving and almost a maternal kind of thing. If somebody showed up that could give me that, it was like, you got to go, because I need somebody that I got to work for. I need somebody that I got to prove to, instead of just somebody that'll just be that for me. So, yeah, the people that would love me, I pushed away, and the people that I couldn't, I clung onto like a life preserver.
Yeah, people who have a lot of attachment trauma and that plays out in their adult relationships as codependency, they often become the high desire partner, that they are attracted to people who are low desire partners because it allows them to love fully if the other partner is distant. And it's only when that partner turns back towards them and wants them, that's terrifying. As long as the, yes, that's the terror. So that a lot of times that people that have that attachment trauma are finding partners that are perfectly, Harville Hendrix talks about this, that romantic love is the glue that keeps two people together that are perfectly mismatched for each other.
Oh my God. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It makes me feel so much better having these pieces as a result of our conversations. Because with all of my addictions, the one that was the most demoralizing for me was the codependency. The drug addiction, the alcoholism, the gambling, all of that is like, okay, I'm an addict, you know? But the codependency made me feel really weak. And when somebody would say to me, a partner especially would say to me, damn, you're just so needy. I felt like somebody had ripped in and tore whatever strength I had out of me. But I also needed them to say that. I needed that demoralization. Yeah, I just needed it. I can't really say what it was for. And when somebody showed up that honored my strength, I don't know about you. You don't get to stay.
Do you remember me? I think the last time that we talked, I did that. Talked about that quote from Viktor Frankl.
I think Do it again.
Between stimulus and response, there is a space.
Right. Yes. Yes.
In that space is our power to choose our response, and in our response lies our growth and our freedom. So, what's happening to people that have high A scores that have attachment trauma? Is that every time that they're close to another human being, that space is collapsing. They don't have the space to choose. What are they doing? They're doing an instinctual behavior of aggression or avoidance, of fight or flight. And they're elegant. They are sophisticated, and there are lots of nuances in the way that we do fighting or flying relationally. But ultimately, it's all reduced down to I'm either being aggressive or I'm being avoidant in those situations. And to be able to start to get into the solution about that is that we got to regulate it's back to the autonomic nervous system, that I got to get that space open back up so that I can choose how I'm going to be in that situation rather than it being like I'm sitting on the doctor's table and he's got his red mallet. And hitting my knee, and it's, you know, it's just reflexive. And that's what it was for me in relationships for so long. You know, I was a serial monogamist for about 30 years. You know, after 90 days, I couldn't sustain desire or connection anymore, and I had to find somebody else. I just could not sustain that connection because of what happened after 90 days is the person I was involved with started seeing me in ways that I didn't want to be seen. They were seeing my flaws. They weren't seeing me the way that I was projecting, you know, the perfect Eric. They were starting to see behind the cracks in the mirror. And that's when I just couldn't tolerate letting somebody see me as flawed as I was.
My last relationship, when I first met the lady, I had a business that was successful. I had a new car. I was going to the gym every day. I was at my peak. We got hooked up. She was successful. She represented all these things. She was beautiful. And my life became about doing what I thought she needed me to do so I could keep her around. Period. In the process, my business went to hell. I stopped going to the gym. I stopped taking care of myself. And everything became about that. About quote unquote, performing for her. I've had an accent my whole life. I'm from Kentucky. Of course I got an accent. She was from Jersey And all of a sudden, I'm saying ing. It's looking instead of looking. And I changed the way I talked. I did all kinds of stuff to try to be what I thought she needed. And in the process, the thing that attracted her to me in the first place, I believe, was my power. But I gave it away. I just gave it up. And I became somebody other than the guy she met. So it's a real dance. It's a real dance.
To look at this from a little bit different perspective, too, and then I'd like to move into the solution with this, but looking at it from a little bit different perspective, also what codependency is, another way of looking at it is other validation. What I found out that my drug of choice was not opiates, but it was your approval. That, you know, I engaged in every single interaction that I had with every human being up until I was about 40 years old, that I was subtly, James Masterson called it closet narcissism. I think that's a really cool term for it. You know, it's like sneaky narcissism. It's really, you know, I look like I'm a really nice guy and I'm there to help you, but it's all about me. It's all about trying to extract from you my worth. The problem with that is you can't ever get enough of it from the external to be okay. It's like, you know, it's got a short little 5-second half-life. As soon as I get the attaboy, man, I'm, you know, it's like, give me another one.
Yeah.
It's got a shorter half-life than any dope I ever did. You know, it was like just such a debilitating addiction to need my worth confirmed externally. And, you know, where that's where the steps ultimately take us is where we finally find a power greater than ourselves that allow us to embrace our flawed selves. And, you know, I'm not all that in a bag of chips, but I am worthy.
Right.
I am a good human being. I do deserve love. I do deserve connection with another human being. And I don't need you to approve of me for me to be okay.
Right.
And that's what a lot of people have called stage two recovery.
Right. I was interviewed the other day by a guy that wanted me to talk mainly about hope. And the thing that he wanted to talk about that would bring the hope about is my bottom. And when he first asked me about what my bottom was like, I said, which one? Because there was a bottom that brought me into the 12-step rooms, December 3rd, 1984. And that was all about the dope. But the bottom that really turned my life around was my bottom around the codependency, which ended me up in a mental ward, getting electroconvulsive shock treatments, and then a homeless shelter with 16 years clean and sober, because the demoralization of needing another human being so badly to be okay was beyond comprehension. And the powerlessness of it. I remember I would be laying in bed and she would be up reading the newspaper. And I would lay there and I would think, she needs to be in here. But then I had so much recovery under my belt. It's like, Johnny, stupid. She's just reading the damn paper. Go to sleep. I couldn't stop going in there and trying to manipulate her into coming to the bedroom. And finally she would, but she would come pissed off, so I didn't get what I wanted anyway. But the thing is, that was my turnaround. That was my real turnaround to growing up, was finding that bottom. Because that really was more of an addiction for me than the drugs ever were. And as I'm talking to you, the thought that I'm having is that the addiction to the drugs was about trying to deal with the codependency. It was like a self-medication. I couldn't get it from there, so let me do it with the dope. So does that make sense, Eric?
Exactly. That's what the stuff that I was talking about last week, or the last time we talked, around Gabor Mate's work, and that the true root of addiction is failed relationships.
Yes.
That's the problem, is that that's what addiction does, is that it's a way to continue to peel off and not have a secure and committed relationship with other human beings. Because it's terrifying.
Yeah.
It's terrifying.
Right.
It truly is. Now, I want to riff a second on a word that you chose, because it's also, you know, in one of my books, my most recent one is called Forward Facing Trauma Therapy. But the second half, the subtitle of that book is Healing the Moral Wound. And you said you were demoralized.
Yes.
And that's the seed of the solution of the problem here. so that when I work with couples and individuals that have this kind of fear and engaging in behaviors to try to keep their partner around and not upset them, to take care of them, to try to manage, you know, what codependency really is me trying to manage another person instead of me managing myself. Right? I mean, that's kind of what it is.
When I laugh, it's because you got me. You just nailed me to the wall, dude. Yes.
I mean, we're master manipulators, aren't we? I mean, we really, truly, at some point, believe that we can control other people. And that's crazy. That's evidence that we need a second step in our life, for sure. So, you know, one of the ways that I start working with folks is I help them to see that they're in violation of their integrity when they're engaging in those behaviors. And so what's a really cool way to do that is I ask the person, give me three words that articulate who and how you want to be in the context of your partner. The person that you love, how is it that you want to be with and towards them? And what would be those three words for you?
Loving.
Uh-huh.
Gentle. Gentle is a big one for me. And
cool.
Kind.
Loving, gentle, and kind. How frequently were you in violation of those three things?
Oh, all the time.
In your relationship?
All the time.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, but what all was difficult, I had a sponsor at the time that he was perfect for me at the time because something would go on between she and I, and I'd tell him the story. He'd say, well, that sounds noble. And he'd say, well, what's a story you don't want me to know? What was going on behind that that you don't want? What's the other story? Because my answer would be, well, I just want to love her. I just want to be nice to her. And he's like, yeah, right. Let's get to the truth of that. You just want her to be nice to you. So you do these things. So, but being honest about that was tough, man, because it's hard to look at. You know, you're all these niceties that you think you've been doing your whole life really aren't about being nice.
It's been a shtick, a game.
Yeah, yeah, and it's been about what can I do to get you to do what I think I need you to do so I'll be okay. That's what it is. It ain't a damn thing about being nice. But the beauty of that was getting honest about that was the only way I could change it. Becoming aware of that was what I was doing and then saying, damn, all these years in recovery that I thought I was working on my selfishness and self-centeredness, all I was doing was just getting more clever about how the hell I was operating from it.
And yeah. A different way of saying that is that, and I share the same with you, is that we continue to live in our disease.
Right.
We had not yet opened up that, you know, it was all secretive. It was all the language in 12-step fellowships is we're only as sick as our secrets. And that was all one big secret, was that it was all held underneath. We had not yet opened that up to the light of letting other people see into that. And, you know, our sponsors, our God, opening up and surrendering that. Instead, you know, relationships and finances are kind of the two things that we keep to the very end before we start to surrender and open that stuff back up.
Well, you know, in the secret thing, to me, the thing is about that is the one I kept that the biggest secret from was from me, because I really thought that I was being loving, gentle, and kind. I had convinced myself that I was being loving, gentle, and kind. And I was blessed with somebody that could come into my life and see the truth and in his own way help me to see it. Okay, Johnny, what's the story behind that shit? That sounds, I used to love, well, I say I loved it, it really pissed me off when he would say, that sounds so noble. That sounds so noble. Now let's get to the truth, boy. And then we would. And the other thing that he kept pointing out that was kind of a nice way for me to start to turn it around was he would say, you have no idea how habitualized you are to your behaviors. So what I would do if I would catch myself, here's just a simple example, going to a movie with her and wanting to see a particular movie and then having this real clever, hidden way of manipulating that. So what I became capable of is catching myself trying to do that. And when I would, I could say, Johnny, that's a bad habit that really doesn't serve you. Let's just say, I want to see this movie. And when I would, it worked. But the thing is, even if it didn't work, even if I didn't get to see the movie that I expressed, I felt better about me. And that was the golden nugget.
And that's the solution. That's where I was wanting to head, is that I didn't go looking for this, but 10 years ago or so, I discovered it. I was a blind pig rooting around the mud, and I found an acorn. And the acorn that I found was that human beings cannot live in habitual and willful violation of their own integrity without getting sick.
Got it.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, that's incredible. And the thing that I believed this for a long time, not saying that I acted on it, but I believed it for a long time. Denial only goes so deep. Some part of your soul knows, period. Part of you knows the truth. And that's why, you know, I've always gotten a kick out of people saying they use dope to numb their feelings. And then a meeting or two down the road, they'll say, well, by the time I got here, I wasn't feeling anything. And I'm like, well, what were you numbing? So there were feelings that we just didn't know how to hold on to. But the thing is, when I was robbing and pillaging, the thing is, I could justify the hell out of it, but only so deep. The justification wore thin as it got deeper into my soul. And it was like, some part of me knew there's no justification for robbing your grandmother of her most prized possession so you could go get dope. There's no justification, no matter whether she didn't take you to your ball game on Thursday or not, there's no justification for doing that. Some part of my soul knew that. And I think that's so for all of us.
And when that's active, there's no way you can stand on your own two feet and allow yourself to be loved.
Right.
There's no way. That house of cards crumbles.
Right.
And so that's what the fear becomes so great, that we transition, that what all of that codependency stuff is an involuntary, instinctual way of managing how afraid we are. And the solution is to start to cop to the fear. You know, I'm afraid. I am afraid of being close to somebody. I wrote a song about that in the Clean Songs, Crawling My Way Home. I'm afraid, but walking through my fear. I'm trembling, but I'm solid. You know, that kind of process of being able to be a beginner mind at 45 years old, to start to connect with another human being and to kind of embrace my flawed self and to recognize that I am scared, that being connected to another human being scares the stuffings out of me. I mean, that, to cop to that. You're a Southern boy, too. It's just, you don't do that. No. I ain't afraid of nothing, you know? And to get 45 years old and find out I'm afraid of everything, it can be a little bit jarring.
Yeah.
And I'm especially afraid of connecting with another human being. And when I can start to cop to that, then what I can do is I can begin to regulate my body. I can begin to through my relationship with my higher power and through developing skills of softening the muscles in my body. What happens when I do that is I am not compelled to act anymore. I don't have to do my shtick. I don't have to act out on one of those things. And I get that space where I can choose to speak the truth instead of shucking and jiving, instead of game playing. And the more that I do that, the more it repairs my morality, and the more that I can tolerate myself being loved and own my flawed self and let myself be okay with another person being close to me.
Wow. You know, one of the things you worked intensely with me with when we were working together, when I was coming out of the mental hospital, is that you kept telling me, Johnny, you got to face the fear. You got to face the fear. Because I was always in fight or flight mode. And I had a night that I hope I never forget where the anxiety and the fear were eating me alive. And what I had done up to that point was I would go out and I would walk, I would run, I would get on the phone. I had to do something. And one night in particular, I said, you know what? I'm going to sit right here on my couch and I'm going to be with this. And that's exactly what I did. I sat there for probably 2 hours. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm afraid of, but I'm here to face it. Something started shifting for me that night. The reason I know it started shifting for me, that was the first night that I had gone to sleep and slept a good solid 6 hours. period. I hadn't done that in forever. So I wrote something a while back, and I had an artist draw an illustration for it. I used the dragon a lot to symbolize fear. And it says, you must face the dragon to become the butterfly. And to me, that's it, man. It's like I can't run from all those fears of what it's like to be close to someone, what it's like to let somebody know me. I heard somebody say one time, we were in a thing about intimacy, and he said, well, look, if you really break it down, what it's saying is into me see. And I loved that. I didn't like doing it, but I loved the idea of what he was saying. But it's the truth. It's like letting you see who I really am. And you brought up that Southern boy thing. Man, I couldn't let somebody when I was a young man in Kentucky know that, you know what, I'd really like to raise butterflies. I really like to write poetry. Are you kidding me? So, but yeah, that's who I am. It's who I've always been. And I always tried to hide from it because it wasn't okay. So today I know I can be a man that raises butterflies and has a fish pond and collects angel figurines, and it doesn't make me a sissy.
That's right. That's right.
It's a beautiful thing in my world.
And to say that a little bit differently, you know, the fellowship that I attend has some literature that says recovery begins with surrender. And the first blush of that is that meaning recovery is abstinence, and that the way you get to abstinence, you stop using and you stop fighting. But when you turn that into a daily process, what that means is that I have to surrender multiple times during the day. What that means is that I'm afraid. And if I don't relax and come to believe in a power greater than myself, what happens is I am conscripted to act out against my will on my disease, in my fear. The surrender process is I let go of the tension in my body. I come to believe in a power greater than myself, and it allows me the fortitude to walk through those situations with integrity and get to the other side. And that's, I think that's what recovery is that ability to step into things that are scary. And that's what addiction of any form, whatever you want to call it, you know, alcoholism, drug abuse, gambling, codependency, that's what addiction is the failure to walk into fear.
Wow. I love that.
The last thing I'll say is this, is that most people do walking into fear with brute force.
Right.
And you can't sustain brute force. No. It overwhelms and you say, F it, give me a hit, whatever the hit du jour is.
Right.
Back to the old behaviors, that the only way to sustain that is surrender. Not energy, but dialing down.
Right. And the thing is that came to my mind when you said that, the brute force is just another part of the fight or flight. It comes in a different form. It's the same damn thing. It's just, but now I'm facing my fear, you know, because I'm going to whip my fear's ass or something. But like you said, it's like relaxing and just being with it. And man, I hate it, but we're running out of time here, but I could talk to you on this stuff forever. So I'm going to ask you to give the people a little information about yourself. And if you want to wrap this up with one line or a couple lines, just go ahead. But yeah, we need to start closing it out. Tell Laura, people how to find you.
Okay. I'm the vice president of Arizona Trauma Institute, and we do lots of different trainings around trauma, and all of the resources that I've been discussing are available on that website. It is aztrauma.org is the website, and all of my contact information is on there. You can go to that website, and myself and Bob Roten are the co-owners, president, vice president of that organization, and we do trauma training all internationally. I've written several books. You can see them all and all the products that I do there, and this is my job, but it's also my mission, and if I can be of service to anybody that's hearing this, then you are welcome to contact me, and I will do my best to bring the resources that I have to bear to offer you help out of wherever it is that you are. It's a privilege to get to do this with you, John.
Man, I'm telling you, Eric, I love you more than I can say. And I just want to say to the audience, because I said it on the last show, but I didn't say it on this show. When I was at my lowest moment, that bottom that I mentioned in the show, Eric was one of the people, actually the big light that took my hand and led me out of that darkness. And I can never say grateful enough for how you put this stuff to work in my life, Eric, and got me out of the darkest hell I'd ever been in my life. So thank you.
you're paying it forward, and that's what we do. And that's a beautiful thing. So it's a privilege to get here, to be here with you, you know, however many years, 10 years later, and that we're both still alive and we're both still in recovery and still doing the do. That's a beautiful thing.
All right, everybody, I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank Eric for being here, and I want to ask you to please come back and watch on my website, johnnycalloway.com, for all the things that's going on with me, all the other podcasts, and stay tuned for the Course in Miracles class that I'm going to be doing online, because I am. It's coming, I promise. So thank you very much, and have a great day. Okay, everybody, thanks for listening. Remember, never give up, always keep it real, and take time to smell the roses, and please sit down and watch a butterfly. Keep up with all that we are doing by going to morphintoanewyou.com. Thank you very much.